You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome, by the way, to Canavan Public Access in Bennington, Vermont. It is now picking up our program, and to LynnCam in Lynn, Massachusetts, and reaching surrounding cities and towns, also picking up our show. And it's Friday, so, of course, it is Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, our national town hall meeting, your opportunity to talk to a United States senator. I think of him as America's senator, but the great citizens of Vermont, or the citizens of the great state of Vermont, rightly claim him as theirs. I was one for many years and feel a particular affection both for the state and for Bernie. Bernie, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. Our Brunch with Bernie, our sanders.senate.gov, by the way, is the website. So tell me if I have this right. Yesterday in the United States Senate, the president put forward another piece of his American Jobs Act, and it actually, which would have put, you know, ultimately 450,000 Americans back to work, and it got actually enough votes to pass the Senate, a majority votes, or, you know, with Joe Biden, I don't recall if it was 50 or 50.
No, majority, yep.
Yeah, it got a majority of votes, and yet it's not law. What's going on over there?
The reason is that in an unprecedented way, Tom, in recent years, the Republicans have filibustered everything and have demanded 60 votes. And we didn't get 60 votes. I think we got 51 votes. So it's a majority, but it is not the supermajority that 60 votes requires. And I want everybody to understand what the issue was. The president and I and the overwhelming majority of the American people believe that it is absolutely imperative that we rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. And we don't have to go into a great lengthy discussion about why that's so, because everybody in this country knows why it's so. People know that our roads are in disrepair, that about one quarter of our bridges are structurally in poor shape and need to be rebuilt. They know that our rail system, compared to Europe, Japan, even China, is way, way, way behind, that water systems and wastewater plants all over America need an enormous amount of work. So you have that reality, and then you have the other reality that we are looking at 16% of our people, either unemployed or underemployed, some 25 million Americans, that within the construction trades itself, unemployment is much, much higher than that. So here we have the need to rebuild our infrastructure, the need to put people to work. The funding for the $60 billion project would come from a surtax on income above $1 million. So 99% of the American people would not pay higher taxes. And yet we could not get one Republican vote. And to the contrary, they filibustered. I think it is becoming increasingly clear that these people are much more interested in defeating Obama than they are in creating jobs. Yeah. But I can't think of a clearer example of Republican obstructionism than what happened yesterday.
Yeah, and this was 0.7% tax on money after the first $1 million
right.
has been earned. The first $1 million,
so
no tax
million,
increase.
You actually wouldn't pay any more. If you make $1,000,001, you'd pay on that first dollar.
Yeah, you pay 0.7 of a penny.
Right. and it's ironic. You may have been reading that more and more millionaires themselves are saying, look, you know, we're doing really well.
Yeah, 68%.
We're doing
saying,
really well. We want to help America. Yeah. And you got these right-wing ideologues whose only approach to economics is more tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, even when these guys don't even want it. More deregulation. You know, they apparently learned from the deregulation of Wall Street how wonderful that was and how we've got to do even more. Got to deregulate the Environmental Protection Agency so companies can produce more pollution, make our kids sicker, and unfettered free trade. That's about it. That's their three ideas for growing the economy. All three have failed. Now, the other issue that's out there, which is a very big issue, and I hope people pay a lot of attention to it, is the super committee. And I had requested the majority leader to hold a caucus yesterday, which he did, in order to discuss the issue, because there were some reports coming out that suggested that some of the Democrats on the committee were pushing for a very, you know, large and complicated project, which would have included cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And I wanted to make it clear that I, and I am certainly not alone, I believe that that is a terrible, terrible idea. It's an interesting moment in politics, Tom, because I think the American people are coming together on certain very fundamental issues. Number one, they understand that it is both immoral and bad economics for the gap between the very, very rich and everybody else to continue to grow wider. So you're seeing with the top 1% earning more income than the bottom 50%, top 400 people owning more wealth than the bottom 150 million people. American people see that. And ironically, whether you're a Republican, whether you're an independent, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're progressive, you know what people are saying? We think the wealthiest people in this country, who are doing phenomenally well, whose real tax rates are the lowest in decades, should start paying their fair share of taxes. Okay? And people understand that we have corporations. There was a study that came out the other day. 25% of major corporations pay nothing in taxes. Right. People want us to close those loopholes. People want us to take a hard look at military spending. So my position to the super committee and what was discussed in the caucus was, look, our job is to bring forward a realistic deficit reduction plan which says, yes, the wealthy to start paying their fair share. You end all of the corporate loopholes by which corporations avoid paying hundreds of billions in taxes. You take a hard look at military spending. You do not cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which especially in the middle of a recession is a life and death issue for tens of millions of our fellow Americans. That should be a program. And if the Republicans choose not to support that idea, and that's likely that they won't, then we go to the American people and we say, that's what this issue is about. That's the division, political division in this country. And you know what? There are a hell of a lot more people on our side than there are on John Boehner or Mitch McConnell's side on that.
Yeah, we just need to make it clear.
Right.
Now, you've got, I mean, you know, this gang of 12, I call it, the super committee, is six Democrats. And,
yes.
And my recollection is Patty Murray and John Kerry are on that committee as well.
And Max Baucus up in the Senate.
Yeah, although Max Baucus I don't quite consider a Democrat. But you would think that at least John Kerry and Patty Murray would be drawing a line in the sand. I'm baffled by this.
Well, and, you know, and it may well be. You know, I don't want to. They're in the middle of negotiations.
Right.
I think the Democrats have stated publicly, and I do not want to speak for them, that there will be no agreement unless there is revenue.
Right.
But the devil will be in the details. How much revenue? Where does revenue come from? Revenue could come from the middle class. It could come from the very wealthy. So I think our point has got to be crystal clear, and it's a point on which the overwhelming majority of the American people agree with us, is that the wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well. Their effective tax rate is the lowest in decades. They've got to start paying. And not to compromise on that. Because once you start muddling the issue, and once Democrats start talking about cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, then people are going to say a plague, which they're already saying, a plague on everybody's house. There is no difference.
Yeah.
So I think the Democrats have got to stand strong on this issue.
Yeah, this is a Harry Truman moment, it seems. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Sanders.senate.gov is his website. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. From this point forward in the hour, we'll be turning the calls over to you. Your opportunity to talk to Senator Sanders, 866-987-THOM. We'll be back with Senator Bernie Sanders.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can check out Bernie's website, subscribe to his newsletter, get the link to his Facebook page, all kinds of cool stuff over at sanders.senate.gov. It's a great news resource.
The people know the Democratic Party is the people's party, and the Republican Party is the party of special interest, and it always has been and always will be.
Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Yeah, Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions. Solomon in Hot Springs, Arkansas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, I just wanted to tell you guys about what happened to me today. I'm here at the Arkansas Environmental Federation Conference, and one of Representative, what's his name, Griffin's aides was here talking about regulations because this is a, you know, environmental conference. And he used the issue of allowing miniature horses in stores as a laugh line to criticize regulation. And, you know, that really bugged me. So I got up and asked him a question. You know, I asked him why, if he was not aware that that was the case, and that was he not aware that horses were allowed as guard dogs, and he really didn't have a good excuse. He just kind of came up with the line that there has to be a line drawn somewhere. And I asked, do we have to have disabilities as a laugh line in an issue like that?
Okay, so that's your question for Bernie?
Well, you know, I think very often what anti-environmentalists will do, this is what right-wing Republicans do all of the time, is they will take a situation, sometimes it may be true and sometimes it may not be true, but just one little example of something, and say, see, this is how absurd regulations are. Government is regulating, da-da-da-da, da-da-da. What a joke. Let's all laugh at that. That's why we've got to do away with regulations. What is behind that quote-unquote humor is an effort to destroy the Environmental Protection Agency so that large corporations and coal companies and oil companies can go forward with greenhouse gas emissions helping to destroy our planet, or destroy the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, which have been enormously successful in improving the quality of our air or water. And what they do is they will seize on something which is they think funny or ridiculous, and then make this broad accusation that, you see, now we have to bring about massive deregulation. The fact of the matter is that there are people all over this country today who are alive, who are not sick, because we have cleaned up the air and cleaned up the water. We have to do more. But to allow the coal companies and the oil companies and those companies that are dumping crap into our waterways, to allow them to continue to do that would be a terrible legacy to leave to our kids and grandchildren.
Amen. Frank in San Diego, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, good morning. It's great. I'm a great fan of both of you, Tom Harmon and Senator Bernie Sanders. It's an honor speaking with both of you. And this is a question, you know, that I'm putting out there, even though Senator Sanders, you know, is an independent. He's not a Democrat. But so Obama has received more money from Wall Street than most presidents in recent history. More deportations than any other president. And Republicans want Obama to be a one-term president. They have said and stated that publicly every day since Obama was elected. What is Obama and the people who support Obama? I voted for Obama. But what is he doing himself to for his own reelection campaign?
Well, Frank, thanks for that question. And I think you're asking a question in a general sense that a whole lot of people are asking. In my view, Obama ran probably the strongest and best campaign that I have ever seen in my life in 2008. He raised expectations quite high, won a lot of support, and inspired a whole lot of people. And I think it's fair to say that in many respects he has disappointed many, many people. And you raise one of the issues, and that is he not only received a lot of money from Wall Street, the people on his financial team that he appointed, from Bernanke as reappointing him as head of the Fed, to Geithner, Secretary of Treasury, to Larry Summers, his former financial advisor, with a few exceptions. He also appointed Elizabeth Warren, which I thought was a great choice, something I pushed very, very hard. But by and large, his financial team has been very conservative. I think what you are seeing, maybe, Frank, in the last couple of months as the president is beginning to catch on, that you and a whole lot of other people are disappointed. And his tone has changed. I have been very critical of him on this program and many other venues about how much he has conceded to Republicans in these negotiations. But what we're beginning to see, and I hope it stays, is a president who is saying, you know what? The rich have got to pay their fair share of taxes. We need to focus on jobs and job creation. Tom and I were just talking a moment ago about a very good, I think, not that didn't go as far as I wanted to go, but putting $60 billion into our infrastructure is an important step forward. That was the president's idea. So hopefully, Frank, the president is hearing from a lot of people in his base who are disappointed, and hopefully he's getting the message that he's got to stand up a lot more vigorously for working families.
Bernie, we have a little less than a minute. How would you suggest that people work to support him in doing that and get more members of Congress to be speaking like
Look,
that?
We have got to be very loud and clear and tell the president that he cannot ignore the base that elected him. I mean, Frank's point is right. He did get a lot of money from Wall Street. That's no great secret. But he has now got to be listening to ordinary people who are going through the worst economic times in our life. And people are hurting, and he's got to be bold. He's got to take on these right-wing extremists, Republicans in the Congress. And you can't be, you know, sitting around negotiating with people who want to destroy your presidency and could care less about ordinary Americans.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Your calls for Senator Sanders coming up next. Stick around. We will be back with more.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. There's an enormous amount of great information there.
Lost working time is lost money. Every day that a workman is unemployed, or a machine is unused, or a business organization is marking time, it is a loss to the nation.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls. Dan in Asheville, North Carolina, listening on Main FM 103.5. You are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Senator. I read the other day that Senator Jim Webb from Virginia was had a disagreement with the president regarding the tax increases in the jobs bill. And I read he would have preferred tax increases on capital gains and dividends. And I just wanted to get your take on that, how you felt about it.
Well, I support increasing taxes on capital gains and dividends, which are now lower than the taxes that working people pay. But I also support a surtax on millionaires, which is the proposal that was on the floor that funded would have funded the jobs program. So I think Senator Webb's point is a good point. And as we go forward, for comprehensive tax reform, to make our tax system more equitable, those are exactly the issues that we have to deal with. But, I think that right now, a very simple, progressive, and straightforward way to raise revenue, to rebuild our infrastructure, and to create hundreds of thousands of jobs is a surtax on income above $1 million. So I think that is proper, but I also support Webb's position in a broader sense.
Kitty in Charleston, South Carolina. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I thought I heard that they were finally, the Commodities Future Trade Commission was finally going to impose some position limits. But I don't know if it happened. I don't know. I'd just like to hear what the senator has to say.
Thank you, Kitty. The answer is yes, but not as quickly as we want and not as strong as we want. What Kitty is talking about is that under the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Bill, Congress demanded that the Commodities Future Trading Commission, the appropriate agency, stop excessive speculation in commodities. I have been concerned about oil. I come from a state where a lot of people have to heat with oil, and obviously we're concerned about the price of gas at the gas tank for all working people. What we believe has happened, and more studies back us up, is that the price of oil soars, not because of supply and demand primarily, that's part of the picture, but because of excessive speculation by such Wall Street companies as Morgan Stanley and others. In fact, what we have reason to believe is that 80% of the oil futures market is controlled not by people who use oil as an end product, like the airlines or trucking companies or fuel dealers, but people who are in the oil futures market just to make money and to speculate. Dodd-Frank demanded, had a law mandated that in January they have position limits. They didn't do that, but a few weeks ago they did. They were not as strong as they should be. They were a little bit better than we had feared. They will not go into effect right away, but it is a step, Kitty. They have acted. It is a step forward.
Okay. Matthew in Portland, Maine, you are on the air with Senator Sanders. Matthew?
Yes,
you're on the air.
Senator, I have two questions. Actually, one question regarding two pieces of legislation regarding the Postal Service.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what you might think about the H.R. 1351 by Mr. Lynch, mm-hmm. and if you know anything about the legislation introduced by Mr. Lieberman a couple days ago.
Yeah. Well, what Matthew was talking about deals with the future, how we deal with the future of the postal system. All of us know that the world has changed. A lot less first-class mail is being delivered because of email, and that it is important for the Postal Service to become a responsive organization in the 21st century. The Postal Service today is having financial problems, but here are a couple of very important points. The Postal Service itself are making recommendations, which I think are bad recommendations. What they want to do is shut down post offices all over rural America, which I think is a bad idea. I think you can shut down some, but not as many as they want. They want to shut down distribution centers in Vermont and all over this country, which would end up slowing mail delivery so that if you drop the letter in a mailbox, people may not get it for 5 days. They want to shut down Saturday mail delivery. You do all of those things, what I think you are really doing is laying the groundwork for the end of the U.S. postal system, which I think would be a disaster for America in a whole lot of ways, not to mention the loss of a significant number of jobs. So we are working with Steve Lynch in the House of Representatives from Massachusetts, who makes the important point that a lot of the financial problems associated with the Postal Service today is not just their revenue in a recession, which is real, but more importantly, a lot of accounting issues. They have been asked to contribute a huge amount of money toward future retiree health care, far more than any other agency or government, or we believe any private company has asked them. A very onerous contribution. Also, there are other accounting issues about when they ceased in the 1970 to be an agency of the government, to be a more independent agency, we think that they were forced to contribute more to other government retiree programs. So we want to get the accounting situation right, which we think will strengthen the financial situation of the post office. We also want a new business model to enable the postal service to compete in the 21st century. For example, right now, if you walked into a postal service and you said, hi, is anybody a notary public here? I want them to sign something. They can't do that by law. If you wanted to go to get a copying, something copied, they can't do that by law. If you want to get a hunting or fishing license, they can't do that by law. So the question is, how do we make the postal service vibrant in the 21st century? France, other countries have made some interesting changes, and I think we've got to look at that. So I am sympathetic to Lynch's bill. Lieberman's bill has some good things, some bad things. Actually, we are having a town meeting for anyone in Vermont interested on Sunday in Montpelier High School starting at 12 o'clock just to discuss these issues. We're going to introduce our own fairly comprehensive legislation in how we can save the post office and prevent 120,000 workers from losing their job.
That's absolutely great. Anne in Los Angeles, you're on with Senator Sanders.
Oh, yes, thank you, Senator Sanders. It's a pleasure to speak to you. You're a real hero to all of us. I was curious to know, I mean, obviously since the Republicans are so successful in stalemating a lot of what would help this country, to vote them out of office would be a solution. What do you think that the DNC can do to shake things up before this next election and really move to get some more progressive people and maybe even move some more independents into office?
Well, Ann, I think what we should do, and in fact I do believe what is happening, is we're seeing somewhat of a transformation in American politics. What the Republicans and Karl Rove and those guys have been very, very successful in doing over the years is creating scenarios by which they get working class people to vote against their own best interests. That's really what they have been focusing on. So they say, you can't vote for this candidate. He or she is in favor of gay rights. Or this candidate is in favor of, you know, some form of gun control, or a woman's right to choose, or one of a dozen other issues that are out there. I think the American people are catching on that this is a real smokescreen for a party whose real agenda is to protect the interest of the wealthiest and most powerful people in this country. So if you look at some interesting polling, you say to Tea Party people, working class Tea Party people, what do you think about making cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? And you know what they say, Ann? They say, no, not a good idea. We don't think so. And you say to those same people, what do you think about asking the wealthiest people in this country to pay more in taxes? They say, yeah, we think that's a good idea. So I think what we have got to do is focus on economic issues, understand that there will be differences of the people's opinion on abortion rights, on gay rights, on some environmental issues. But I think if we focus on saying, look, middle class of America is collapsing, everything being equal, unless we change this system around, your kids are going to do worse than you are. If we don't get our act together as a nation, we are on the path of becoming a third world nation. Do you want that? That's what we've got to focus on. And we're beginning to see that. That's what this 99% movement is about, in saying the people on top are doing phenomenally well. They want you to be fighting over abortion rights and gay marriage. That's what they want you to do, instead of looking at why is it that the rich are getting richer and everybody else is getting poorer? Why are we losing 50,000 factories in the last 10 years and 5 million good manufacturing jobs? Why is it that working class family can no longer afford to send their kids to college? Why is it that 50 million Americans have no health insurance? So we got to focus on those economic issues, bring people together, and make the kinds of changes that we need politically.
Brunch with Bernie today, our hour with Senator Bernie Sanders, our national town hall meeting. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. His website, sanders.senate.gov. And you'll find there not just a good senator's website, but also a great news resource.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls for Bernie right after this.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, Senator Bernie Sanders, and our national town hall meeting taking your calls. Roberta, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Tom, we should remind people that
Hang on just a second. Roberta, hold on just a minute. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bernie.
You should remind people that that clip you just played was FDR 1936.
That's right.
And they won that election. Was it 46 states to 2?
Yeah, I don't remember that, the numbers, but I know it was an absolutely overwhelming sweep. He just cleared the board.
And he made it very clear whose side he was on and whose side they were on. And that is precisely what President Obama has got to do.
Yeah. And similarly, in the election of 48, I think it was, when Harry Truman said, you know, the clip we played earlier, when he said the Republicans have always been the party of the fat cats, The Democrats took control of the House and held it for the next 46 years. So it's you're absolutely right. Roberta in Minneapolis, you're on with Senator Sanders. Roberta? No, Roberta's gone. Greg in Parlin, New Jersey, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, first thing I'd like to say is we cannot have supply-side economics and free trade at the same time. It's impossible. We have an enormous revenue problem in our country. We can raise the taxes on the rich and untangle the corporate loopholes, but it will not create one job. If we don't put large tariffs on all imports that will create a demand, we are on a fast track to becoming a third world country. I want to know why our legislatures are passing more free trade agreements when the previous free trade agreements have caused 17% unemployment with 22 million unemployed hardworking Americans not able to pay their fair taxes since their jobs have been outsourced, causing our enormous revenue problem to run our state and federal governments. I want to hear one more thing. I want to let the American citizens know that Dodd-Frank left out regulation of derivatives trading. And thank you.
Greg, I more or less agree with your position on free trade. I have voted against all of these free trade agreements, including the recent ones with Panama and Colombia and Korea. I think that if you look at the results of the China Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, CAFTA, what you will find is that they have been abysmal failures, that they have resulted in companies shutting down in America and moving to cheap labor countries abroad and then bringing their products back into this country. So you're asking why that happens, and I'll tell you why it happens. This is an example where many people in both political parties come together, in my view, to represent corporate interests. You had Bill Clinton pushing NAFTA, and you have Republican presidents pushing other trade agreements. Obama was pushing the recent trade agreements. Corporate America likes these, and unfortunately many members in Congress continue to support that concept, despite, from my perspective, it's very clear failure.
Steve in Phoenix, Arizona, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Mr. Sanders and Tom. How are you folks doing today?
Good.
Fine.
Great, great. One question I have, but before I go to that, is there was a great clip by Ted Kennedy on the Senate floor a few years ago, and it stated, "When does the greed stop?" And that would be a great clip to play, and it ties in really good with this vote on the 0.7% tax on a dollar over the million made by, you know, the millionaires. That'd be a great clip. But the question I had is, since we've all been herded into 401s and IRAs, you know, in the recent history here, pensions have been on a decline. Is there any legislation that's out there to try and bring back Glass-Steagall and possibly reinstate the uptick rule, where the stocks can't be shorted so much?
There is legislation to reinstate Glass-Steagall. I think Maria Cantwell of Washington has introduced that or will introduce that. And there is a discussion among many members of Congress that clearly Wall Street has to be re-regulated, that what happened during the 1990s, that whole deregulation process pushed by Alan Greenspan and Robert Rubin, Larry Summers and those guys, has been an unmitigated disaster. Dodd-Frank took us a little bit of the way, but nowhere near far enough. So to answer Steve's question, yes, there is thinking about it. We're going to have to take on, obviously, a very powerful Wall Street, who wants to be left alone so they continue to do their mischief and exercise their greed in any way they want. But I would say also, Steve, we got to take a hard look at the Fed. I have put together a committee of some of the best economists in America to help me and others come up with new come up with real reform of the Fed so that it begins to work for ordinary Americans, and that the tools of the Fed can be used to create jobs and not just to protect the interest of Wall Street, to protect consumers so they don't have to pay 25 or 30% interest rates on their credit cards, to protect homeowners. So there's a lot of ferment going on there. But I will tell you that Wall Street remains very, very, very powerful, and they will resist any change that will limit their freedom to do what they want to do.
Bernie, we have calls from Minnesota, Washington, Pennsylvania, California, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Vermont, Michigan, but we also only have 40 seconds left. I'm sorry. Your final thoughts for the hour?
Well, there's just so much. I mean, I walk into the office on a Monday morning or a Tuesday morning, and I kind of walk out on Thursday or Friday, and would just shake your head because so many things are going on. I just urge people to pay attention. Watch what the Super Committee does. Let your members of Congress know. No cuts to Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. Keep pressure on Congress to demand that they create a real jobs program that puts our people back to work.
Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Thank you, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our show, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, literally from L.A. to New York on Sirius XM, all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across the Americas, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV and several hundred cable systems nationwide via Free Speech TV. More people watch or listen, more Americans and people around the world, to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive show, talk show in the world. Welcome back to our program, and we're so pleased to have you with us. Former Congressman Alan Grayson is with us, and congressmanwithguts.com is his website, has been for quite some time. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's a great show. I'm always happy to be on.
Thank you. Very pleased to have you with us. And it's right to call you a congressman because that's a title for life once you've been a congressman, right?
Yeah, like felon.
Yeah. and the fact of the matter is that you're working on becoming a congressman again, which is something that excites me and I know a lot of our listeners. Class warfare versus class surrender is kind of the topic of our conversation, but I just want to put it right out there that you're also you're working to get back into the United States Congress. You're the kind of guy we need, and you've got an event coming up here. Tell us about this.
Yes, we're doing an online money bomb. We've done this four times before with great success, and it's our own little experiment in campaign finance reform. What I'm trying to do is to make shameless appeals to the public for cash in lieu of shameless appeals to lobbyists for cash. These kinds of appeals go ahead in smoke-filled rooms behind closed doors in Washington, D.C. every day, and the lobbyists are the recipients. What we're doing instead is we're inviting people to come to our website, congressmanwithguts.com, and make a contribution to our campaign, and with the understanding that they're not going to get anything in return except for good government, and that seems to be enough for people. We had almost 100,000 people come to our website in the last election cycle, congressmanwithguts.com, and make a contribution. And so far, even though I announced barely 3 months ago, we've had 15,000 people come to our website, congresswithcuts.com, and do that, make a contribution, because they understand that the alternative is too horrible to contemplate. It's that the lobbyists will end up owning the government.
Yeah, and to a large extent already do, and which is why we need more congressmanwithguts.com. We need more congressmen with guts to get into the Congress. And I think it's spectacular that you're going to the people rather than going to, Monsanto or GE or whatever. It's just this is what we need in America. This is one of the core problems we have. Class warfare versus class surrender. I'd love to hear your riff on this. Warren Buffett says, yeah, there's class warfare and my class is winning, or his class is winning. Your thoughts on this?
Well, as I said on the Ed Show on MSNBC a few days ago, we're heading to that choice. We're heading to the choice where the only alternatives left will be class warfare or class surrender. In effect, the rich have been and have been conducting a war against the middle class in this country since Reagan was elected, and they're winning. They have dismembered labor unions. They've destroyed public education because they use that to attack the teachers' unions. Mm-hmm. And they've torn apart the social safety net. They've destroyed the ability of people to see a doctor when they're sick. Even such indications as car ownership are now starting to drop in this country. There's a whole bunch of people now who can't even afford to own a car, much less a home. If you look at the statistics put out by the Federal Reserve, the last few years are the first time in decades when car ownership in America has been declining. These are all tangible signs that the middle class is losing that war. The fact that we have 24 million people who can't find a full-time work, the fact that we have 50 million people who can't see a doctor when they're sick, the fact that we have 47 million people who need the government's help to feed themselves, the fact that we have 15 million families who live in homes where the mortgage is higher than the value of the home, they're underwater and they do feel like they're drowning. These are all indications that there is class warfare already, and our side is losing. Mm-hmm. And that will mean the end of the middle class in America. We'll all turn into wage slaves who will basically be working in order to pay their credit card balances, or at least a part of their credit card balances at the end of each month.
Yeah, and, you know, before Reagan, people would graduate from school typically, or even college, high school or college, typically without debt and or with very minimal debt. And the debt that they would acquire would be buying a house, which is, an appreciating asset over time. That would become their retirement, you know, for example. When my dad died, his house was paid off, and that was there. Now you've got young people graduating from college so far in debt that they're going to spend half their working lives just paying off their student debts, which, you know, fortunately, I think, you know, the president has recently taken much of that away from private corporations. But you have banksters who are charging obscene rates of interest on this stuff. What, as a member of Congress, what would be the areas that you would focus on if enough people went to congressmanwithguts.com and helped you get reelected back into your position there representing the 8th District of Florida, Congressman Alan Grayson?
Well, we have to take this enormous opportunity that exists right now, because people are starting to wake up, and use it to make sure that the government is a government for the people. Mm-hmm. Right now, the government hands out enormous goodies, bailouts to Wall Street, hands out enormous goodies in the form of contracts, billion-dollar contracts, to the military-industrial complex, which is why we see perpetual war. Hands out tax breaks to the filthy rich and to multinational corporations who take our jobs and move them overseas. All of that is an indication that, as the saying goes, the system is broken. And that's the one thing that the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street seem to agree on. The system is broken. And it's not that hard to figure out how to fix it. We need progressive taxation. We need to make sure that, as Warren Buffett has pointed out, his secretary pays less in taxes than he does. We need to make sure that that we take care of our own human needs. Let's not worry so much about rebuilding Afghanistan, rebuilding Iraq. Let's talk about rebuilding Detroit, rebuilding Orlando, which I represented. We have crumbling schools. We have crumbling bridges. My kids, until this year, I have five kids in public school. My kids, until this year, went to school in trailers each day.
Wow.
This is, and I don't live in a poor area of Orlando. Orlando is not, not upper class, not lower class. It's right in the middle. So you see, what we're doing is we're taking all of this huge amount of money that is generated by our wealth each year, and we're spending it to make the wealthy wealthier. The rich get richer in large part because of all the favors they get from the government, and that has to end. We have to make sure that the government stops helping the rich get richer, and we also have to make sure that when people need a helping hand, they get a helping hand. Healthcare is a good example of that. In the last Congress, when we had a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, a Democratic President, we ended up with a bill that will give 30 million people who cannot see a doctor now the chance to see a doctor. And, you know, you're never going to be wealthy unless you're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kind of things that we need to accomplish, just common sense things, making sure that children have the opportunity to be educated to the best of their ability, making sure that sick people can see a doctor and get better. How are you going to be able to join the workforce if you're too sick to get out of bed?
Yeah, absolutely. In the little less than a minute that we have left, I'm just curious if you think that 2012 is going to be a change election, that beyond just your own candidacy, we're talking with Alan Grayson, congressman with Guts.com, the website, beyond just your own candidacy, that maybe Nancy Pelosi is right when yesterday she said the House is up for grabs.
It's too early to say, but I will tell you that as time goes on, it's going to be clearer and clearer to people that the real choice is between a decent life for ordinary human beings and giving unbridled power to money and to propaganda.
Yeah, and which is what we've been doing since Reagan came into office, basically.
That's right.
So, okay, Alan, former Congressman Alan Grayson, congressman with guts.com, the website, trying to pull together his money bomb for the weekend, and actually, not just trying, doing it. And so get over to congressmanwithguts.com. Congressman Grayson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Great talking. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. 866-987-THOR.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we're going to check in with actual sitting Congressman Charlie Rangel right now about the jobs numbers that just came out and what's going on with unemployment. Plus your calls. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Congressman Charles Rangel on the line with us, rangel.house.gov, his website. And, Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Good always to be with you, Tom.
Thank you very much, sir. The economy, the private sector of the economy, added 104,000 jobs, according to the most recent report from the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. However, governors in predominantly Republican states laid off 24,000 state workers in that same period of time, so we only netted out 80,000 jobs. Republicans have laid off almost 500,000 workers in the states and a little less than 500,000 workers at the federal level in the last couple of years, which is keeping unemployment high. What do you make of this whole situation, and what, as a member of Congress, do you think can be done about it?
Well, the last part, you got to give me more than time than I have allotted as to what we can do about it, but the one thing is that when the Republicans make up their minds that they're going to reduce the deficit just by cutting programs, and I hope it's changed, but their position has been and is today that revenue raising is not on the table, then the whole idea that cutting programs and cutting spending necessarily means that you're saving money. You can always cut back in police and fire and public workers, but what problems are, why did you hire them in the first place, and what happens if they're not there?
Right.
It's the same thing as closing up the emergency room in a hospital. You can close that down. But if the people that went for emergency treatment cannot get it, then the expense that it's going to be, besides the pain and misery, it just doesn't make sense just to talk about cutting. And so here we have what? Besides a deficit problem, we got a jobs problem.
Yep.
And so if you tell them to resolve the jobs problem by cutting programs and laying off people, it doesn't make any darn sense at all.
Yeah. Yeah. No country has ever cut it.
Talking about the health industry, you know, is a big thing to say they got to save money, but they got a lot of low income people working in these hospitals that now will be applying for unemployment compensation.
Right.
So it just seems to me that if you want to deal with the problem, you got to first start talking with each other. My only fear is that on both sides, they don't believe anything is going to get done to get people back to work, and they're locking themselves into a campaign mode rather than trying to at least take time out, do something as relates to jobs, and then fight on ideology between now and the election next year.
Yeah, isn't to some extent that what that a symptom or a problem or a factor in what's going on with the Gang of 12, the so-called super committee that is...
Is what a factor?
The fact that there's a campaign coming up and that pretty much anything they do is going to be used. I know a couple of them, at least one of them isn't running for re-election, but I believe the rest of them are. And you know, that you know, the Republicans are afraid to raise taxes because they'll go against Grover Norquist, their patron saint, and the Democrats are now actually talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare, which seems to me like political suicide. I'm baffled by the whole thing.
Every day, and they're mumbling and they're not saying what's on their mind. And the fact that this whole cockamamie idea that 12 people are going to be substituting 535 people, it just doesn't make sense to believe.
Yeah, government by gangs.
That the House and Senate is going to swallow whatever they come up with politically, and they can't avoid the politics of it. And it doesn't make sense to me that the president and Pelosi and Boehner are proud of the fact that they're not interfering with these 12 people. I know, as a former chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, that I could do anything I wanted. But if I did not get the direction and support of the leadership, it wasn't going anywhere. And so the whole idea that they have removed themselves from the deliberations as to the question you're talking about, cutting Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, hey, what are you talking about, with or without campaign? Not having money on the table, not being able to have a fair tax on people while they're telling the poor and the unemployed that they must suffer, that's not going to fly. And so unless we can get those things, which you don't have to be a genius to see the problem, unless we can get a clear understanding as to what's on the table, then we're just spinning our wheels, and they'll be talking about the sequestration. And having said that, with the sequestration, you have to recognize, as brutal as it sounds and using a meat cleaver to cut across the board, that doesn't happen until after the election, and the Congress ends every 2 years. It really terminates and over.
So in other words, if the super committees, whatever they do, doesn't pass, and this so-called meat cleaver falls, it doesn't fall until after the next election, which means that the next Congress can say, yeah, we didn't really mean it, and we're going to fix it. We're going to actually, if we can get enough people elected, you know, like yourself, you know, if Congressman Grayson can get his seat back, if we can keep good progressives, if the Progressive Caucus can grow the way that the Tea Party Caucus grew in the last election, and we can move some of those Tea Partiers out and have a change election, that we can actually bring this country back.
Tom, you make a lot of sense. I can't talk that way because I'm encouraging them to reach a conclusion that is good for our country and not just our political ambitions.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Yes, the way it's set up constitutionally, because there is some question in my mind whether there's room for a super committee.
Yeah.
And there's certainly no room in the Constitution telling me that I have to vote to support what their findings would be. But having said that, for those people that would vote for sequestration, it does not come into
impact. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call
866-987-THOM.
Congressman Charles Rangel, rangel.house.gov. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. You have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. You know, the Koch brothers have been saying, no, we're not, we got nothing to do with the Tea Party. Mitt Romney came out yesterday and said that they are the, quote, financial engine of the Tea Party. Right. Interesting. Very interesting. Another very interesting thing, and it's Anything Goes Friday. I'm going to pick up your calls in literally just a minute or two. I just wanted to point this out. The Republicans in the state of Michigan have passed through the Republican-controlled Senate in the state of Michigan a law that would basically eviscerate the state's anti-bullying law. The state's anti-bullying law was passed as a result of children committing, particularly teenagers, committing suicide at alarmingly high rates, particularly gay teens, because they're being bullied for being gay. And so they passed this law. It was named after this kid who had committed suicide. And now the Republicans are saying that they want to pass an exemption to this law saying that you can't be prosecuted for bullying if you're doing it based on moral convictions. In other words, if you hate gays because you believe that God is telling you to, then you can go ahead and bully them until they commit suicide. And you can't be prosecuted for it or held to account for it. This is what the wonderful Republicans in the state of Michigan, and I guarantee you this is going to be coming to your to the state near you next. This is what they're doing instead of trying to put people back to work. Let's have more teen suicides. Tell me this isn't not only nuts, but morally criminal. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the, you know, what I think that the Occupy Wall Street is all about. People are looking for something as far as, to counter the pervasive greed and avarice in our society. And I think it's a very important issue in the sense that we all kind of buy into it. We're brainwashed from the time that we're born and we're exposed to television and advertising and whatnot. And I think that essentially what the Occupy Wall Street movement is about is it's a moral revolution.
Yes.
And I think that I also would like to point out, as I had called the other day, about the discipline of economics and the kind of education that we get. Our education has been hijacked by economists, schools of business, which are publicly funded, and are teaching people, leaders of society, that greed is a good thing.
Yes.
So in a sense, we're cultivating the very thing that is destroying us in terms of community, in terms of ecology, and we need to counter the Alan Greenspans of the world and the Milton Friedmans. And you're absolutely right to trash Ronald Reagan. When I hear his name, I cringe. I lived through that. I remember the bumper stickers, poverty sucks, etc. I got my million, you get yours. And this is contrary to community. This is contrary to what I was brought up.
Traditional American values.
Traditional American values, but human values.
It
yes. goes beyond just America. This is, you know, liberal economy is incredibly evil, and we need to destroy it. The countries that are doing the best know how to keep it in check. Look at Norway. Look at Denmark. I got a call from a friend who lives in the Netherlands, is married to a Dutchman, and she asked me, well, do you have money invested in the stock market? And it's like, well, I didn't have a choice. I don't have a national pension system that picks up two-thirds of my former salary. That's what every Dutch person gets. A little country that is essentially subsiding into the mud is able to produce for their citizenry. Why isn't it that we're able to do that here? Because of greed. And we need to destroy these ideas. Are incredibly dangerous, and they're killing us.
And
literally.
They're being promoted aggressively by cranky billionaires like the Koch brothers and of the various front groups that they fund the various chairs and seats and all these universities that they fund.
Yes,
and not just the Koch brothers.
These think tanks, you know, when media organizations, they should say, this is the think tank that, you know, supports these ideas. They should educate people.
That was funded by so-and-so. No, John, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And we need to be pointing that out. Judy in Faiston, Vermont. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Yes, hi. Tom, first of all, thank you for your comment. Get the word out. Mm-hmm. When I listen to Boehner and others twisting things around, they sound so convincing. And I think that's one of the things that the others of us have to do, is to get the word out in that kind of way, the true word. Bernie, I am one of your anti-free trade cohorts from Faiston. And
Bernie's not on the line right now. But
oh, he's not.
No,
oh.
I'm sorry. He does 1 hour, and that hour is gone. You're listening to a time-delayed show on WDEV. Is that it?
Oh, I guess so.
Yeah, okay.
Because I just heard from 1 to 1:30 here.
Sorry about that.
Oh, bummer. Okay, well, anyway, thanks for your comment about getting the word out.
Okay. And
I think that's really important.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Judy, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Steve in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yeah, yes, hello, Tom. How are you? First, I wanted to tell you how much myself, my family, and all the many of the people I'm working with that Occupy Wall Street respect the work you're doing.
Thank you. I got to say, you know, I'm doing the easy work. This is. I'm sitting here in a comfortable studio, and you know, at a reasonable temperature, 77 degrees. We got all this electronic equipment, and you know, the people who are out there in the freezing cold and spending the night in sleeping bags, and you know, putting up with the police macing them and throwing tear gas at them, they're doing the really hard work, and I respect that. So, you know, just for the record. Anyhow, what's up?
The reason I'm calling is that many of us here are very concerned. There's a vote coming up tonight at 7 o'clock at the General Assembly that if it's handled incorrectly, it could tarnish the overall global image of Wall Street, of the Occupy Wall Street.
Okay, is this at the Occupy Philadelphia General Assembly
meeting?
Yeah. Okay.
Here's
what's happening. What's the vote?
At 7 o'clock at night, they're going to vote whether or not they stay or they take Mayor Nutter's and the city's offer for us to move a mere 16 feet away, so a $50 million project that has been planned for years can start.
Mm-hmm.
So if they vote to stay and dig in, what's going to happen, the mainstream media is going to kill us. They're going to say, look at this. They're supposed to represent the 99%. They won't even move to let hundreds of people get jobs that are really needed right now. They're not going to move to let a project that's basically set up to allow the handicapped much better access to the city. They're not allowing that to happen. They're not going to allow a general economic boom to happen in Philly. And the mainstream media is going to get a hold of this and totally tarnish the message we're trying to put out there.
Steve, I'm not part of Occupy Philadelphia. I don't know the issue. I don't know the details, and I don't know the people involved, so I can't speak to that. I mean, what you're saying sounds real reasonable, and typically what you find when you have, you know, pure democracy, when you have, you know, everybody has an opportunity to speak and you have consensus decision-making, is that the common sense stuff is what prevails. And so I'm, you know, assuming that what you're saying is the case, I'm guessing that that's how it'll go, But you said your piece on it, and you got your message out. If there are, you know, to the folks in Philadelphia who are listening, and you know, let us know tomorrow what happens. Okay.
I will. Thank you so much, okay. Tom. Again, we really appreciate your work.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate your calling in and being part. You know, I'm starting to say occupy something at the end of every day's show, and I think it's an important one. Martha in Carrboro, North Carolina. Hey, Martha, what's on your mind today? Martha. Martha, you gotta listen to your phone. Dan in Stockton, California. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was wanting to talk to Senator Sanders, but I can talk about this on here with you too.
Okay.
What I object to is how these banks and these huge corporations can have billions and trillions of dollars, you know, in held back in reserve, while all of the city, state, and county governments are all broke all the way across this country. It seems to me like, you know, the federal government produces money. So how come they can't have a stronger control of that money and see to the distribution of it to where, you know, there's not starving people out in the streets and everything while, you know, rich CEOs, they're right. Actually rolling around in
money.
Well,
here's the problem. If the federal government simply manufactures money out of thin air, then what happens is the value of money is a function of the amount of money in circulation relative to the amount of goods and services in circulation. And so when they're in balance, you don't have inflation and you don't have deflation. If the money supply goes up radically and the amount of goods and services doesn't go up, in other words, the economy doesn't grow, then what happens is the value of that money goes down. That's called inflation. If, on the other hand, the money supply contracts, as happened in the early 1930s, and the amount of money out there goes down, the Fed actually dialed back the available cash in 1929, 1930 in response to the Great Depression, which was the exact wrong thing to do.
I understand all that about, you know, printing more money. I'm not talking about printing more money. I'm just saying that the print should be controlled.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's theoretically the job of the Federal Reserve, and I think instead it should be the job of the Treasury Department, and that's why I think that the Fed should be federalized under the Treasury Department. Thank you, Dan.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your calls coming up. Anything goes Friday for the rest of the day, although we will be checking in with the Talk Radio News Service in just a few minutes to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
Herman Cain is scheduled to speak this afternoon at the Koch Brothers Americans for Prosperity's Defending the American Dream Summit.
They hijacked this from Van Jones?
Yeah, think so.
Yeah, okay.
Great title. The event's open to the press. So I think he'll face some more questions in his ever-shifting series of answers about allegations that he sexually harassed several women while he headed the National Restaurant Association in the late 90s.
Does open to the press mean that the press can ask questions, or simply that the press – I mean, I went to a Karl Rove event in Portland that was open to the press. We had to stand behind a velvet rope line. There were guards around with guns, and it was made very clear to us that if any of us spoke, we would be hustled out really, really fast, probably with a gun in our back. And so all we could do was record what Mr. Rove in his infinite wisdom had to say. Are you sure that you're going to be able to actually ask Herman Cain a question?
Well, it's varied this week. At the American Enterprise Institute on Monday, it was open to the press, but the press were forbidden from asking about this topic. At the National Press Club later in the day, that was a topic that they were allowed to ask about. Then he's tried to stay away from it. And then on other occasions, according to people who know, he cannot be stopped from talking about it, despite receiving advice to the contrary.
Right.
He won't shut up.
You know, I'm not sure how let's assume for a minute that he actually did come on to some women and some of them were offended, and, you know, that's sexual harassment and the payments were made and all that kind of stuff. I've been running this through my head. How could he appropriately? This is a guy who's pushing 70 years old, if my recollection is correct. I mean, he's of a different generation. If you watch Mad Men, you know, those people who are younger than 50, you want to see what it was like back in the 50s and 60s. What today is called sexual harassment back then was called normal. And so, you know, what if he just came out and said, okay, you know, I said things that today are considered wrong, but back then weren't. But that would blow up in his face. Or what
it
if,
would.
You know,
well,
or
I
don't see any way out of this for him other than a full confession, which means he has to pull himself out of the race, basically.
It has to be a full confession, except when you look at the results of the Washington Post ABC news poll, where he's doing remarkably well with Republican primary voters who don't seem to care and seem to think it's
fine. And that Republican base might be the Republican base that is largely the same age as him, that has the same attitude toward women as him, or even younger men who have the same attitude towards women as him. And they just don't, you know, it's like Rush Limbaugh obviously doesn't care about this. He's making jokes about it. It may well be that the best way for him to handle it is, hey, yeah, so what?
Well, and then the other piece of it also, of course, is that these women are nameless and faceless, and the stories
so far
are not fleshed out. Right. So I think as long as that continues, it's easier for people to disparage them and either to say that they don't exist or they're anonymous, they're afraid to come forward, or they're liars. Once we start to really hear these stories in detail, I think it will become more difficult. I think people started to take some of it seriously when they heard that he actually suggested somebody should come to his apartment. People then started to say, well, that's not the same as saying you look nice in that dress.
Right. And not only that her job might depend on it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think people are starting to take it more seriously now.
Now, here's my problem with the whole thing, Victoria. This guy has no campaign staff, no on the ground in any state. He's not actually running for president. He's running for PR so that he can increase the speaking fees he gets from his motivational speeches and he can sell more books. And in fact, when he travels around the country doing, quote, campaign events, end quote, what they are book signings.
And of course, even if he does a complete mea culpa at some point, if he decides to admit it and to come clean, suppose it happened, right, and he decides to take that route, a well-worn route for televangelists, for example,
right,
it's not going to hurt him with his base.
I don't think so.
Who wish to forgive.
Yeah, and that's and particularly this works on the Republican side. I mean, you know, look at David Vitter, for example.
Right.
It doesn't work so well on the Democratic side. You know, look at the former governor of New York, Eliot Spitzer. He actually left office, you know, over one of these things. David Vitter, on the other hand, comes out, makes a confession. There's this Christian idea of confession and redemption that I think fundamentalist Christians in the Republican Party take very seriously, and they really believe that, you know, if David Vitter made a confession, that he's now washed clean of the sin, and he can be back in the Senate, you know, up to whatever he's up to.
But it's a little odd how nobody seems to be among the Republican base questioning the fact that on the one hand it's a high-tech lynching, which is racial. On the other hand, it's the liberal media. And on the third hand, it's Rick Perry.
Right.
And on the fourth hand, it's anonymous lying women.
Right, right. Okay, what else is going on besides Herman Cain?
Well, we are waiting for a confidence vote in Greece to determine the political future of Prime Minister George Papandreou, but also reaching far beyond that, because it could be a turning point for the future of the Eurozone, and of course a lot depending for the world economy and us here in the United States on that. And that vote's not going to happen really pretty much until midnight Greece time. And Papandreou only has a majority of two MPs, and some MPs have threatened to vote against him. We don't know how he's going to do. Much might depend on who shows up for the vote.
If he loses, mm-hmm, does the Greek government go – he's a socialist. Does the Greek
right.
government go to the right or to the left?
It would go probably to the right, but it might go to technocrats. There would probably be elections called, and they might have some kind of unity government of technocrats.
So this would be
sort of like
what's going on in the UK right now, you mean? A coalition? Is that?
No, that's a coalition of politicians. This would probably be a coalition possibly of civil servants, maybe. But it would be almost impossible for him to form a coalition with the New Democracy Party because they hate each other.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always good speaking, always informative speaking. We will be back with your calls and thoughts and some of mine here on In and Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. If you go to TomHartman.com, you will see up at the very top of the page that Heist, a new movie, for the movement, Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? This is a brand new documentary that has just come out, or is just coming. It actually hasn't hit the theaters yet. It's like in kind of pre-release form. It is going to be shown at Occupy Wall Street in L.A., and it's, let's see here. I just got this information just a few minutes ago. I'll tell you what, over the next couple of minutes, I'll get the details. Jacob, if you could find the details on that thing and just highlight them for me on that story. There's a link to it off TomHartman.com at the top. It's a story on Alternet, and we'll get those details to you for those of you who are listening to us in Los Angeles on KTLK. Roberta in Minneapolis. Hey, Roberta, what's up?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I need help. I need an explanation, and you're really good for that. In the Senate, when they don't allow the majority to pass a law, it has to be the 60 vote, and they call it a filibuster. Would it not be helpful if they made them actually filibusters so that it would be on the news for more than one day?
Yes.
And especially since they say on the news always that a bill was defeated.
Yes.
Well,
yeah.
The
bill was not defeated.
Why don't
you're right.
They do it then?
Well, in part is what you're talking about. The second part of your question is sloppy journalism. We have you know, and this is why the Republicans have been able to get away with this, by demanding 60 votes on everything when, you know, there's only 100 members of the Senate. And
we know the journalists are going to do it, so why don't we turn around and make them actually filibuster?
Well, and that's the first part of your question, and Bernie Sanders has actually tried to change the rules. This has to do with the rules of the Senate and how the rules of the Senate are organized. And the Senate votes on those rules, and 51 votes, by the way, can change the rules of the Senate. So it is possible that if Harry Reid had 51 senators who would go for it, that he could say, okay, from now on, instead of simply announcing I filibuster and everybody says, okay, that's it, we'll set that aside and go on to the next thing, you're going to have to actually stand up and start talking like Strom Thurmond did when he filibustered the Civil Rights Act in 64, and he stood there for 28 hours or whatever it was and peed into a bucket by his leg. And people brought in pizzas. I mean, you know, do the old-fashioned filibuster. Bernie tried to bring that back, and that's why he stood on the House floor for 8 hours and talked. But the Senate rules didn't require that. He was making a point. He was doing that. And that's been turned into, by the way, a book called The Filibuster by Senator Bernie Sanders. It's basically the text, an edited version of the text of his filibuster. And it's brilliant. But this is a matter of Senate rules, not law. And those rules are passed by the senators. And I'm all in favor of it. Bernie's all in favor of it. I know a number of other senators are all in favor of bringing back a real filibuster or having a real filibuster. But I don't think that there's 51 who are in favor of it. So that's the problem right now.
Does it have to be, do the rules, I thought the rules could only be changed like at the beginning of a new session. Is that true, or could they vote on it right now today?
They could vote on it right now today. They would have to have a vote to change the rules. And I may be wrong, but I don't think that vote can be subject to a filibuster because they just did have a vote to change the rules, and 51 people voted for it, and this was to prevent filibusters of amendments. And that was when, a week or two ago, everybody was all hysterical that Harry Reid had pulled the nuclear option, and so that there couldn't be a filibuster of amendments, or there was some limitation of amendments. So he actually changed the rules just a week or two ago. By doing this. So I don't believe, I know at the beginning of every legislative session, which is every 2 years, with every new Congress, there is a kind of a pro forma vote to accept last year's rules or to amend last year's rules with specific amendments and say these are the new rules that the Senate will operate by. But I also know that it is possible with a majority of votes to change those rules. In fact, that was the nuclear option that was talked about back when Sam Alito was going to be put on the Supreme Court, and you had Democrats talking about filibustering it, and because he was, such a toxic guy, and it turns out that they should have filibustered it. He is a toxic guy. But that's how it works, Roberta. And so the people that you need to talk to are Amy Klobuchar and Al Franken. They're your senators.
Al Franken.
Yeah.
Right.
And ask them to support an effort to change the rules to require a real filibuster. An actual stand there and talk filibuster if you're going to have a filibuster. Roberta, thank you for the call, and thank you for bringing up the issue. It's an important issue. It's actually a very important issue. JD in Napa, California. Hey, JD, what's up?
Hey, Tony, thank you for taking my call, and also congratulations on your standing in the world for a progressive talk show. I'm so thankful for that.
Well, thank you. We've been rated number one for 3 years now by Talkers Magazine. But those things come and go too. It wouldn't surprise me at all if that. We'll see. We'll see how time goes.
All I know is this: if you're number one right now, all we can hope for is more progressive stations coming up.
Well, we're adding. We just added two affiliates this last week, so our show is growing. And something I'm very pleased by. But what's on your mind, JD?
Wonderful. Okay, what I'm calling about, and first one real quick thought is that these people are asking, the banksters and everybody, they want money that they made up. First of all, this is virtual money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you could only collect this on PCs. You could never do this by hand. Okay?
Right.
Now, that's beside the point. My point is that with all of the redistricting, even here in California, I've got another, representative here I didn't know, and all of these kind of things, and let's just assume that most of us are more, that's listening to you, are more informed voters than many others, okay? How do we, And I'm not saying you have the answer, but on each state, each local level, I'm sure we have places we can go, like the registrars, voter register, whatever. Find out that our votes were actually counted. I copy and I keep results, you know, all the paperwork on every vote I make.
Right.
Last election, I had to change my party affiliate, which was other, in order to be able to vote for the people I wanted in office.
Right, in a primary, it would have been.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yes. And, you know, and it's so difficult. So, you know, I think that we need to make sure with the people occupying around the country and around the world right now, and this people's movement is so exciting, but now we've got to make sure that our votes are counted and not just the right-wing votes are counted, which is what it looks like has been happening.
Well, I think that there has been election fraud on a fairly substantial scale, and I think that some of it has been conducted electronically. I think that was the origin of the basis of the whole Don Siegelman case. I think his election was stolen from him in 2002. I think, you know, I think this has been going on since basically the mid to late 90s, and it went on steroids during the Bush years. It might be diminishing somewhat now, but it's still there, in my opinion. Now, that's you know, some people think I'm a conspiracy nut for saying that, but I'll just put it right out.
I don't trust
machines that can be easily hacked by a high school kid that are cheapo machines that are made by companies that have partisan agendas and that are not secure. You know, I just don't trust them. Now, that said, there is a direct answer to your question. How do you know that your vote was recorded? There is no way to know that. And the reason why is because in the United States, we don't keep track of who voted for what. And there's actually arguably a very good reason for that. And that is that, you know, at some point in time, you know, God forbid, if the government ever became very, very oppressive, would you want them to come back and say, you voted for this? No, that's, you know, whatever. Or, you know, maybe a list that could be sold or something. On the other hand, the first 100 years of our republic, more or less, at least up until the Civil War, most elections were held in public. And many of them are still, this is how it's still done in Vermont. In the small towns, we lived in a small town in Vermont for a while. And the way that you hold the elections for town clerk and everything else is everybody shows up in the meeting room and holds up their hand. It's public. It's a public vote. So, you know, the secret ballot is a relatively recent invention, the last 100, 150 years. So it's worthy of a debate in this country.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Free Anything Goes Friday. Check out TomHartman.com to see the movie, particularly if you're in the L.A. area, to see about the movie Heist.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Okay, here are the details. I just got this. Heist will be shown at 8 p.m. tomorrow night, 8 p.m. at Occupy Wall Street, Los Angeles, in front of City Hall. Donald Goldmacher will be there. Earl Katz will be there, the people who put the movie together. They are not sending out DVDs or anything like that. This is a first showing. They will be used as organizing, educational, and fundraising tools by the local Occupy Wall Street groups, and they're raising funds to try to help distribute that to other Occupy Wall Street groups. Heist is a great movie, and how do I know? Because I narrated it. I did the voice, so, you know, the narration, the voice that says, here's what you're seeing on the screen right now. And it's the story of how basically Wall Street, the 1%, robbed us blind. It's a brilliant movie. And or at least the narration part of it. I haven't seen the movie yet, but I know what's in it because I did all the voiceovers for it. So that's going to be shown tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in Los Angeles in front of City Hall. And, you know, where Occupy Wall Street is, or the Occupy LA folks are hanging out. And so let me just recommend, if you're in the Los Angeles area, if you're listening to us on KTLK or any of the other venues, any of the other media that carry us in the Los Angeles area, that you get down to City Hall tomorrow night at 8 p.m. and check this thing out, because it should be, you know, one very, very good time. Rocky in Santa Fe. Hey, Rocky, what's up?
Oh, hey, I was wondering if you knew any of the details of what the agreement reverts back to should the super committee not come up with an agreement, which has been hypothesized that Obama was a genius for setting that up, because he knows there's no way they will come to any agreement.
Yeah, and it may well be the case, and it may well be that there won't be an agreement. I frankly hope there won't be an agreement. And
what does it revert to? I mean,
what it reverts to is automatic spending cuts in both defense and Social Security and entitlement programs. But here's the catch. Those cuts don't take place. They don't take effect until 2013 or until 2012, until after the elections.
So the campaign, right.
Yeah, until 2013. Those cuts take effect in 2013. Some of them take effect in 2014. Some of them don't even take effect until like 2020. And so one of the fundamental principles of constitutional law in the United States is that no Congress can bind to future Congresses. So this Congress saying that if the Gang of 12 doesn't come up with their cuts, that there will be cuts during the time of the next Congress has no legal standing. The next Congress can leave that on the books and let those cuts go into effect, or the next Congress can say, you know, that was really stupid, and here's how we're going to change it. And that what that does is it demonstrates for all of us how high the stakes really are in the election of 2012 and how important it is for Democrats to take back the House of Representatives, to get a strong majority in the Senate, to hold the White House so that, you know, when those cuts are supposed to be taking effect, then, you know, instead we can go in and say, you know, instead of cutting these social actually, there are draconian cuts in the military budget, too, which is fine with me. But, you know, OK, let's have the military cuts. Let's close down bases around the world. Let's stop trying to play empire. You know, we've doubled our military spending since 9/11. That's insane. You know, let's cut back on some of the Department of Homeland Security stuff. We've got all this huge security industrial state that doesn't need to be there. And at the same time, let's start raising taxes on millionaires and billionaires. Let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts. So,
yeah. Well, so I guess then maybe that was a brilliant way to set this up so that this super committee won't succeed.
Maybe. I genuinely don't know the thinking that went on in the White House and in Congress, you know, among the leadership in Congress that led to this. But I can tell you that. Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm just going to switch the topic real quick. Is there a concerted effort to get those 85 Tea Party people out? Like, those are the guys that screwed this all up. That's
Debbie Wasserman Schultz's job as the head of the DCCC. And yes, there's a concerted effort. Absolutely. And this you know, has to go to the state level. Or the local level. This is where movement politics needs to be pushing party politics. And as I said, it never works the other way around, and it's got to be movement politics. Fred in Center Hall, Pennsylvania. Hey, Fred, what's up?
On the same topic of the super committee or Gang of 12, I'm of the opinion that these guys are not going to come to an agreement. I'm also of the opinion that the, quote, Republican Study Committee, unquote, conservative members of the House,
right,
aren't going to go along with any deal.
Right. Even if they do come to an agreement. Yeah, I agree.
You know, and that we're going to go through another national suicide watch like we went through this past spring.
And it may be a good thing, because if we go through another national suicide watch as a result of the committee not, you know, coming through and the cuts going into place, but the cuts aren't there. It's just the sword of Damocles leading into the election. That's going to cause a lot of people to go, wow, there's a lot at stake in this election. Maybe I should show up and vote. So go ahead.
I agree with you. I actually believe that what happened this past spring was the match that lit the fuse for the Occupy Wall Street movement.
You're talking about the almost shutdown of Congress?
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I think the match that,
I mean,
you know,
it was publicly watching incompetence in action.
Yeah, and it may well be. I think it was the Adbusters calling for this, and you know, it just hit a note. It was just the right moment in time. I think that the longer fuse was lit with the Obama campaign, because President Obama went out there and campaigned as a populist progressive, and overwhelmingly young people came out into the political movement who had never participated in politics and said, a populist progressive, I'm going to put my butt on the line and work for this. And unless he becomes a populist progressive fully again, or for the first time, actually, and you know, in what he's doing, and I think he's moving in that direction, Those people are not going to show up. And that's where this whole sort of Damocles scenario comes in, as you point out. And as I point out, that might be a good thing. We'll see.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the insanely ugly, or some other large vocabulary word, plus more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very dykophobically ugly. What was that? A fear of justice. Fear of justice. Very interesting. Brought to you by Edison Factor. EdisonFactor.com. Food for your brain. The good. Bill Gates. Bill Gates? The richest man on the planet had some advice for world leaders assembled in France for the G20 meeting. And that advice was, tax the banksters! While giving a presentation at the G20, Gates pushed for a financial transaction tax on Wall Street, also known as a Robin Hood tax or a speculator tax or a step tax, to help raise enough money for the developing nations around the world. Gates warned, not caring about the instability of these countries really would hurt our economic future quite dramatically, whether it's unrest, whether it's disease. Well said. Bill Gates is at least one 1%er we should be listening to, or at least on this topic. The bad. The Chicago Board of Trade. Once again, banksters in Chicago have resorted to ridiculing the Occupy Wall Street movement camped out below the Chicago Board of Trade building. After throwing insulting leaflets out of the windows the last few weeks, traders threw McDonald's applications out of the window today to heckle the patriots demonstrating below. I guess the banksters are so clueless to how bad the economy is that they don't even realize it's harder to find a job at McDonald's nowadays than to get into an Ivy League school. Earlier this year, over 1 million people applied for jobs at McDonald's, and only 60,000 people got jobs. So maybe these 1%ers should keep their job counseling advice to themselves. They may need it soon enough. And the very, very ugly, the Family Research Council. Not only is this hate group considered to be a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center, but it doesn't seem to know jack about what it means to be pro-family. According to a Sun-Times report, the Family Research Council awarded its pro-family award that recognizes members of Congress who've upheld the institutions of marriage and family best to deadbeat dad Congressman Joe Walsh. As the organization said, we thank Congressman Walsh, who has voted consistently to defend faith, family, and freedom. That's right, divorced Congressman Joe Walsh, who owes more than $100,000 in unpaid child support. He received the Family Research Council's highest honors. And that's very, very ugly. Amazing. Just a quick reminder to our listeners in Los Angeles, 8 p.m. tomorrow night at City Hall at Occupy Wall Street, or excuse, Occupy LA, there will be a free screening in public of the movie Heist. And this is a big deal. This is a really cool thing. The movie is just like in the very earliest stages of getting out there. And it's just, you know, Heist is the name of the movie. I think that pretty much tells you what it's all about. And, in fact, there's actually a subtitle to it. Let me dig that out here. Who Stole the American Dream is the subtitle, which should fill you in even more. Kim in San Francisco. Hey, Kim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, is it just me, or does it seem the whole Greek situation? Greece is like the cradle of democracy, am I correct?
Yeah, arguably. 3,000 years ago, for about 300 years, they had something called democracy. Yeah.
Okay, so part of democracy is giving people the right to vote, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like something outrageous that if the people of Greece are going to be asked to take these incredible austerity measures, that they should have the right to have a say in it.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the old Greek democracy, the 3,000-year-old Greek democracy, was, you know, pretty much everybody showed up and voted. It wasn't so much representative democracy as it was closer to a pure democracy, which is what a citizens' referendum would be, which is what Papandreou was proposing and what he has now walked back from since his meetings with Sarkozy and Merkel and Obama
right.
and whatnot.
So here's what I want to ask. In the whole idea of globalism, I understand that the main goal of it is
the free movement of goods and labor across free trade agreement partners.
Not labor, goods and money.
Goods and money, but they also want a low-wage labor force that can go globally.
That's right.
To whatever third world countries are developing at the time. In
right,
other words,
but keep those people in those countries. It's bizarre that the World Trade Organization and groups like this that promote so-called free trade, they want corporations to be able to move from country to country instantly, or even change their nationality instantly. They want money to be able to move from country to country. They want goods, manufactured goods, to be able to, or services to be able to move from country to country. Services like software and things. I guess that would be a good. But they don't want people to be able to move from country to country.
Why?
Because there's this, a certain provincialism associated with it that people should be stuck where they are, and that way they can be. Frankly, I think, you know, if you want to put a sinister spin on it, and I'm perfectly willing to do that, because if you keep people, third world people, stuck in a third world country and use that as your factory floor, they're not going to be able to leave that country, and because that ability to leave that country and get a better wage is cut off from them, they're going to continue to work for crappy wages.
Okay, well, here's where my original point is. The Greek people were going to have an opportunity to vote on what was going to be their economic future, including some cuts that are going to be devastating.
Yes.
The EU was formed at the behest of Deutsche Bank, RBS, and other investment firms. So
arguably.
The whole idea of integrating economies was set up in the EU. So here they are facing this terrible crisis. And instead of letting the people even have a voice, yes or no, we would like it this way or we wouldn't like it this way, the conglomerates, RBS, Deutsche Bank, etc., went to Papandreou and said, are you kidding?
Well, we don't know. I mean, it's also entirely possible that the politicians in his own party said, are you kidding? That, you know, this is, there's a real loud and genuine debate going on inside Greece,
right,
because there are trade-outs and trade-offs. And it's not as simple as it was in Iceland. In Iceland, they said, do we pay back the banksters or not? And the people twice, over 97% the first time, over 70% the second time, said, no, screw the banksters.
No.
Right. That's it. But there was no, the downside to that is that the banksters in Germany and England and whatnot are no longer going to loan money to Iceland. The Icelanders are you know, they're fairly into self-sufficient. You know, they're like,
unique.
Okay, fine, we
yeah.
don't care. Greece, on the other hand, had, you know, they had to conspire with Goldman Sachs in a way that some have described as being, if not criminal, certainly underhanded. They had to conspire with Goldman Sachs to buy CDOs to push out into the future their debt so that they could get their debt to GDP ratio below 3% so that they could qualify for membership in the EU back, you know, a decade or more ago. And so, you know, that was the original crime, as it were. And that threw Greece into even greater debt. And then, of course, when the debt to Goldman Sachs and all of their buddies that helped Greece pretend to get their debt down to the level where they could join the EU, when that came due, suddenly their debt is above EU standards, and so the EU is saying, okay, you got to get your debt down, you got to pay off the banksters, and Greece is saying, we don't have the money to do this, and they're saying, okay, sell off the Parthenon, or stop paying your civil servants, or stop giving people, et cetera, et cetera. You know the story. But the point is that there are a lot of Greek people who believe that having the euro in Greece and having Greece integrated with the European economy is a good thing, because one of the things about the EU that most Americans don't get is that when you're in the EU, you can move from country to country in a way that you can't if you're not in the EU. So if you're a Greek citizen and you can't find a job, you can move to France and try and find a job. And in fact, this is one of the problems that many of the EU countries are having. It's one of the reasons why some countries chose not to join the EU, that they wanted to maintain their territorial integrity. And so you've got countries, you've got high-wage countries now that have a problem with intra-EU immigration, people from Bulgaria showing up in Denmark, you know, and so the Greeks, you know, a lot of the Greeks, the poor Greeks, are seeing this as a release valve, as you know, as an opportunity. You know, they see there's an upside to this integration in the EU, and if they don't pay off the banksters, they get kicked out of the EU. Now,
right, and basically what they're saying is we will break off your little tiny country and set you afloat. This
right.
Is this not? Is it me? Am I being conspiracy theorist? This is globalism with a gun.
Yes.
This is globalism saying, do what we say, screw your little people. You'll do what we say.
That's right. They have taken the velvet glove off, and the iron fist is now fairly naked to see.
This whole economic system that we've got that is now more than just domestic, it is worldwide,
yes.
is a house of cards.
Yes.
And it is in perilous condition, and everything that went before could just be a precursor to what may come.
Absolutely.
The economic system must be revised. It must be neutered.
It has to be. It has to be. And I think that what's going to bring that about is it's going to crash under its own weight. And maybe and maybe not. I mean, it's going to cause some horrible hardships. That said, if it continues without doing that, it's going to cause even more horrible hardships. And I think it's going to take this major worldwide crash for this thing to be reinvented, to be rebooted. And my hope is that there is enough of a populist movement, and it's growing all across Europe, and you're seeing it in the United States in the Occupy movement, that there's enough of a populist movement that when it really does go down, that we end up with, and we being us, Western Europe, frankly, the rest of the world, that we end up with FDRs rather than Stalins, Mussolinis, or Hitlers, because they all came out of the Great Depression, too. So, that's my
You're take. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More with Anything Goes Friday right after this. We'll be right back.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, to our video directors, Chris Bryant and Eric Hamilton, to our phone screener, Julie Lule, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum at WYD, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate our program, Dial Global on commercial stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations, Free Speech TV Network on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to Mona Kashfi, to Dennis Trunov, Don Rojas, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to Rachel in Santa Fe, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to all the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you so much. Oh, and Jim Javinski, sorry about that, who's doing our video production. And bless you, Jim. Let's see. Anything Goes Friday. Let's get back to it. And Brad in Los Angeles. Hey, Brad, what's up?
Hi, how are you, Tom?
I am fine. I hope you get a chance 8 o'clock tomorrow night to get down to City Hall and watch Heist, this incredible new documentary that's going to be previewed, or it's going to be played. I mean, they're going to show the whole movie there for the Occupy LA, Occupy Wall Street folks.
I'm going to try to make it to that, but the reason I called today, thank you for educating me every day. I was looking, I found a 1982 year-end edition of Life magazine that has an article in it about the economy, and I thought it was very poignant. It says that business failures were averaging 500 a week as interest rates were declining and the stock market was soaring, and the Reagan administration had ran up the highest federal deficit in U.S. history. There were 11,500,000 people out of work, and they were fleeing the Midwest, and it was looking like the Dust Bowl.
Yep.
There were people sleeping in their cars beside Houston freeways and sleeping under bridges in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It highlights a family that was the only job that the father could find was at a coal mine in New Mexico for $3.50 an hour. But the best part right here is the very last paragraph. It says, national unemployment was still rising at the year's end. Forsaking supply-side economics to borrow from the New Deal, President Reagan endorsed a highway and mass transit repair program that he said would stimulate 320,000 new jobs.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I know, you know, Reagan although, you know, so his tax cut, his tax cuts and his Reaganomics did so much damage that he was in repair mode much of his presidency. And David Stockman writes about this and talks about it fairly candidly. If you go to Conversations with Great Minds, I spent a half hour with him on TV, and we had this conversation. And you know, he raised taxes on working people, cut taxes on the rich, but he did raise taxes on working people, and he did do stimulus programs like what you're talking about. And it's like it's all kind of lost to history, isn't it? It's just amazing. Brad, thanks for calling and sharing that. That's pretty amazing. Spencer in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Spencer, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for all you do. This is my second time caller. I appreciate you letting me on.
Thank you.
I just wanted to mention that, you know, according to Eastern religion, I'm not sure about Buddhism, but Hinduism, the Vedic religion, if society takes your life when you've taken someone else's life, you've paid your karmic debt. Otherwise, you're going to pay it in the next life.
Right.
And die a violent death accordingly. So philosophically, I don't have a problem with capital punishment, but I'm totally against it because the corruption in our justice system, from the cop on the street to the bottom of judges to people that can't afford a decent attorney, it should be abolished for that reason alone.
Well, and I don't think anything should be particularly something having to do with life and death should be done because you know, Hinduism supports it, or any religion, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, fill in the blanks. That's, you know, our Constitution is fairly explicitly a secular document. This is a nation of laws, not of beliefs and deities and things. And, you know, so yeah, I get your point, but, I'm with you that this system has become so corrupted that, you know, we just need to do away with the death penalty. It's just nuts. Dave in Vancouver. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You provide a lot of good information that educates not only me, but people that I talk to, relatives and so on. And I was wondering if you or your staff could crunch some numbers for me. You talk about rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. And I was wondering if rolling back those cuts, taking Bush's capital gains reduction to 15%, if we said that that was income again.
Yeah, that was actually happened during the Clinton administration. But
okay.
Yeah.
And if we took the cap off of income for Social Security and we instituted a 0.1% tax on trades on Wall Street, and the last thing, if we returned defense spending to 2001 limits, would we have enough money at that point to balance the current budget?
Easily. I can tell you that without crunching any numbers, because I know that just several pieces of what you just described would do that. And that math has been done by real economists like Dean Baker over at CEPR, the Center for Economic and Policy Research. There's several others, but that's probably one of the best sources. And if you go to thinkprogress.org and click on the economics tab, and you can actually search for these things, there's been a number of posts and blogs and references to things like that over there, too.
Well, you put up such great graphs and charts. I'd like to see that on your program someday.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dave.
I'll
discuss that with Sam, and we'll see what we come up with. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, why have Republicans put BP, Halliburton, and Transocean into the witness protection program instead of making them accountable for their mistakes in the Gulf oil disaster? I'll confront Texas Railroad Commissioner and Republican candidate for U.S. Senate Elizabeth Ames Jones. Plus, the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there, when you show up. Show up in L.A. 8 o'clock Saturday night. Show up. Tag. You're it. Occupy something. We'll see you. See you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.